From KQED Public Radio in San Francisco, I'm Michael Krasny. This week, the American Academy of Pediatrics announced a major change in its circumcision guidelines, which suggests that its health benefits outweigh the risks. U.S. circumcision rates for newborn boys have fallen to about 55% from a high of close to 80% in the 70s. We'll take up the debate of health benefits versus health risks in the hour ahead. Join us after this. From KQED Public Radio in San Francisco, I'm Michael Krasny. Good morning and welcome to this morning's forum program. Presently, rates of circumcision in the United States have fallen from 80% in 1979 to approximately 56%, though the number of males circumcised varies widely from state to state, about 80% of males in Nebraska, Iowa, Kentucky, and Wisconsin as compared to some 20% out here on the West Coast. On Monday, the American Academy of Pediatrics updated its 1999 position on circumcision when its task force took the stand in a circumcision policy statement that there was no clear evidence for or against circumcising newborn boys. The new 30-page report, which appears in the Journal of Pediatrics, does not endorse circumcision and states that the surgical operation, which removes foreskin, should be a family decision. But it argues that the benefits of circumcision outweigh the risks. And in this opening forum hour, we discuss the 14-member task force report of the AAP, which, by the way, represents some 60,000 pediatricians, and it's a report also endorsed by the American College of Obstetricians and Gynecologists, but has also been strongly criticized by the growing anti-circumcision movement. And joining us this morning for the hour is Dr. Doug Dikema. He's a member of the American Academy of Pediatric Circumcision Task Force, a physician and director of education for the Center for Pediatric Bioethics at Seattle Children's Hospital, and a professor in the Department of Pediatrics at the University of Washington School of Medicine. Welcome, Dr. Dikema.
Thank you.
Good to have you. Also good to have Dr. Dean Adell, who, full disclosure, is, I dare not say, an old friend of mine, but a friend for many years. He's also host of a national radio show, well-known in the Bay Area for his work on television, though he is in other markets, and he's an ophthalmologist and surgeon by training. And Dean Adell, good to have you.
It's a pleasure, Michael.
Let me begin, if I may, Dr. Dikema, with you, and let's just begin with why this decision has shifted. It's seriously shifted ground here in many ways, saying now, as I mentioned in my introduction, that the benefits outweigh the risks. This is based largely on what?
Well, our task was to review all of the scientific literature related to circumcision, and with a special emphasis on the last 12 years or so. And on the basis of, you know, reviewing what ended up being over 1,000 scientific studies, it was clear that the evidence is stronger than it was in 1999 to demonstrate that there are significant health benefits to the procedure.
Now, this boils down, as I understand it, a lot to studies having to do with STDs and to also studies on urinary infections and penile cancer?
That's correct. And the newer data is most strong with regard to the sexually transmitted disease prevention.
Which have been criticized as being largely based on African populations, for example, with HIV?
Well, some of them are, not all of them. And it's true that probably the largest studies, the three largest studies that were also that used a randomized clinical trial methodology were from Africa.
There were 14 studies, I believe.
14 total, correct.
Right. Though two of them, and it mentions in the report specifically, that two of them, since we're talking about HIV infection for the moment, show an increase in HIV infection among sexually active men and women.
Yes.
So there is some contradiction in the data, or what?
Yeah, and that's not unusual in medical science to, you know, particularly if you're looking at as many as 14 studies, to find at least a couple that may come to an opposite conclusion.
Well, perhaps most controversial in the report, in addition to whether there's more benefits and risks, is the call for insurance payments, because I know a lot of medical programs have stopped paying for circumcisions. Medicaid programs in several states are ongoing. Let me ask you to address that, if you would, because some of the members of the anti-circumcision movement have said that the AP is acting as a kind of trade associate for doctors' bank accounts. I think that's how they put it.
Well, that is certainly the case they're trying to make, which I think most pediatricians find to be ridiculous. Most pediatricians, quite frankly, don't perform circumcisions at all. To maintain your skills requires doing a fair number of them. And many pediatricians have made the choice not to do them simply because they can make more by seeing patients in their office than by going over to the hospital to do a circumcision on a newborn. So I can tell you that it never was a point of issue with the task force about whether this would benefit pediatricians or not. That it was the decision to address health benefits was one made really on an equity basis. The feeling was that if we're looking at a procedure that appears to have significant health benefits, then financial barriers should not be a reason that a parent could not obtain this procedure on behalf of their child.
Now, let me go to Dr. Dean Adell. Dr. Adell, are we seeing perhaps an impugning of pediatricians in Intact America and other groups who are saying this is all about money?
Oh, I don't think it's all about money. It's just easy from the outside to think that. So I tend to agree with Dr. Dikema about that. It's a much deeper, more complicated and interesting issue than that.
Well, let's go to the issue. Dr. Edgar Schoen, for example, emeritus at UCSF, whom I'm sure you're familiar with, says it's a real health advantage and it ought to be routine immunization circumcision for neonatal boys should be just routine.
Well, let's go back for a second. It is very important that, you mentioned it at the beginning, the statement coming from the American Academy of Pediatrics is that the health benefits are not enough to recommend routine circumcision of newborns. That's really important. The AAP had a tough, tough job on their hands. You have Europe, some countries attempting to ban circumcision outright. European physicians and Asian physicians, all of whom look at the same data and have not drawn the same conclusions. And Dr. Dikema in the Seattle Times, he did mention, and indeed I agree with him on this, that, the proposed benefits, of course, which I disagree with, are small enough that it stopped them from making the recommendation that this should be routine. This could be done, and the AAP says it, by young men when they reach the age of consent. There are very interesting ethical issues here. It's a question whether a parent even has a right to subject a newborn child to a procedure that is not deemed medically benefit. And I think that's very, very important. And let a child grow up and do it himself. And the reason that most American families, and by the way, this business about religious freedom, that's an important one. And I thought the AAP did a decent job by saying it should be available to families who, for cultural reasons, want to do it. But that's a couple of percent of the population. The reason most people still circumcise their child is to have it look like dad or cleanliness. And cleanliness is amazing. I mean, why did God put this thing there? And how come it's deemed unclean? Imagine proposing doing circumcisions. And I heard this, by the way, from an East African doctor on females because they're cleaner afterwards. So it's kind of a very sticky subject. And the most important part is that it is deemed that the foreskin has no function. And every time we doctors have told people that a certain organ has no function and we'll just remove it, we have been wrong. And the AAP tried to consider the sexual effects. And this is very difficult. Imagine doing really objective studies on sexuality. And I just think it has a profound sexual effect. They admit to evidence from, there's a Korean masturbation study and there's these monofilament threshold studies, and they admit indeed that the intact penis is a little more sensitive. The foreskin itself is more sensitive than the most sensitive part of the circumcised male. And there's a recent Danish survey, admittedly, which found all kinds of sexual difficulties and differences. It's impossible, though, to do the kind of study we would like to. So I just think that the overall Academy position I agree with, which it's the health benefits are not enough to recommend, routine circumcision, and that parents should be informed, and it should be done, if it's going to be done, by people who are competent. And I just, I don't think the religious part of this is an issue that I would want to deal with. I think that's a small part of the pie. And why America is so different than the rest of the world, I have no idea. And I'd certainly be interested in what Dr. Dikema thinks about that, why American doctors have this different perspective.
Well, maybe we get you on record on that, Doug Dikema. I know that we go back often to the name Louis Sayer, who talked about circumcision as protecting young boys against all kinds of things, which have now proved no longer applicable, and who also believed that it was much more hygienic, came down on the notion that it discouraged masturbation. I mean, those are the roots, I guess, aren't they?
Well, they're certainly the roots at the beginning of the 20th century. It's also the case that Harvey Kellogg and Dr. Graham of the Graham Cracker, Kellogg of the Corn Flakes, also advocated circumcision as an anti-masturbation strategy. As it turns out, not surprisingly, neither one of they were both wrong about the fact that circumcision changes masturbation behavior at all. But that, you know, there certainly were people at the turn of the century who were advocating circumcision precisely for that reason. It's difficult to know why, you know, by the 60s and 70s, the huge majority of men in this country were circumcised, and it was more or less sort of the standard practice in medicine.
But as Dr. Adell has suggested, in Europe, the numbers are very different. UK, for example, has about 9% rate of circumcision from what we've been able to gauge.
Yeah, that's correct. And, you know, I suspect a lot of that is cultural. I mean, you know, if the place you're growing up tends not to do it, yeah, you're probably going to tend not to do it. And the opposite is also the case.
Do we know, because this report talks about concerns about complications, botched operations, for example, there are reports of about 117 deaths each year. How much has that been factored in to the report and the decision to say that there are more benefits?
Well, it's been factored in a great deal. I mean, the primary part of the analysis we did was to compare benefits with risks. I will say that there are not 117 deaths in the United States that are directly the result of circumcision. The fact of the matter is it's extremely difficult to find a single case that you can tie directly to a circumcision. In other words, it's not related to something else. I mean, for example, there's at least one of these cases that gets trotted out involved a very sick baby that was likely to die anyway, and his parents wanted him circumcised before his death. And to attribute that to a circumcision is silly, that kind of a death. The truth is it's very difficult to find deaths related to circumcisions, particularly when they're performed by a trained provider under sterile conditions in a sort of medical environment.
We're talking with Dr. Doug Dikema, who is a member of the American Academy of Pediatric Circumcision Task Force. In fact, the AAP, is going to be meeting, I believe, Dr. Dikema in October. So is this moving forward in another way? We're still waiting, by the way, I should mention to listeners, for guidelines from the CDC on circumcision. That's been a long wait in many people's judgment. But will there be anything in addition, or do you anticipate anything in addition in October?
No, October is our national meeting, but these circumcision guidelines are, for the most part, done. They've been published in Pediatrics. The task force is effectively disbanded because our sole task was to do a systematic and critical review of the literature and write our reports based on that. So, until 5 years from now, when the Academy revisits this issue and decides whether to continue this policy or have another group revise it, this will be our policy.
So, Dr. Adell, you think this report should be retracted?
Well, of course, activists are calling for that, and Europeans are taking a very radical approach to it. I think that behind the scenes there was probably lots of discussion about the ethics and the religious issues around this, and keeping it available for parents is seen as a defeat by activists. And for myself, I can appreciate the difficulty. I guess I'm being a little more circumspect than you might. you might think, and the difficulty is, and as Dr. Dikema knows, and he stated to the papers, we don't really know the complication rate. It's kind of unknown. we are very unsure about the sexual effects. We're unsure about a lot of things. We're also sure that the problems are supposed to help. You know, it's marginal, and Dr. Deakamas said, you know, these are not common conditions, which is why we did not recommend this routinely for all, you know, baby boys. Urinary tract infections are probably 5 or 10 times higher in little girls, and there may be other explanations. The African studies about AIDS, there's been no study to show that. I mean, in America, this is HIV is a problem of men who have sex with men. It's not heterosexual. It's a different disease. And,
but forgive me, aren't there lower rates of STDs in Europe with the low rate of circumcision being pervasive throughout Europe?
That's a great question. And, you know, you won't find a foreskin in New Zealand, and these boys aren't walking around with dripping sores and all these diseases. We just haven't seen that. And even if we did or didn't, it's hard to say the populations are different. One of the difficulties, I'm sure Dr. Deakman would agree, is that in America, among ethnic minorities, circumcision rate runs 30%, 40%. Among white men, it's, you know, up to 80% in some places. So all of a sudden, you're comparing different populations when you look at STDs, et cetera. Either way, a surgical operation is not the way to stop sexually transmitted diseases. That is absolutely preposterous. If the effort went towards education and helping young people be responsible about it, this would have a much bigger impact. Again, all of these things, I think, is why I agree with the American Academy's position statement that there's nothing yet to show us that we should recommend routine circumcision of newborns. And I think that's a good starting place. So it becomes, you know, a tangled deal for parents to have to deal with. And they call a lot, they spend a lot of time saying parents should get important factual information from their health care providers. I agree. They should get a lot of information that they've not had about the care and feeding of the intact penis, because this is a big issue where women have been, that mothers and fathers, when they bathe the child, may forcibly retract it and cause additional difficulties. So I'm not so upset, mostly because, Michael, I think for you and I, maybe the first time on the air, we've discussed this. People are talking about it, and with discussion comes intelligence and the dissemination of information. And so
let us hope.
Yeah.
But I'm also struck by the fact that the report by the AAP also talks about nerve blocks and, it recommends pain relief in circumcision. That could cause more complications, couldn't it?
Well, the pain relief, I mean, Dr. Deakman can address it, but yes, the shots, et cetera, may cause some problems. I wonder how they address the issue with the bris and the Jewish ritual where a little sip of wine is given to a child. And I must say, when I first began in school, we just would strap a baby down and do it without anesthesia. And I was taught babies don't feel pain. It took a long time for pediatricians to recognize that babies do feel pain. We did oxygen consumption, breathing studies, et cetera. It was actually an uphill battle to convince them. So I'm happy to see that, at least. But I guess it's a small victory.
Could I guess get you to address that, Dr. Degema? Because there are still many who argue that taking a foreskin away, the nerves are not well developed enough to really have an infant endure much pain.
Well, I think that's just wrong. I mean, anybody who's seen a circumcision performed without...
I've seen a number of them. Some infants howl and some infants don't make any noise at all.
Yeah, I mean, I think there's pain there. I mean, there's nerve fibers there. They feel it, and we have an obligation to reduce that as... as we've already talked about, we know that infants feel pain, and we know that pain can have long-standing effects in terms of the way their brain develops if it's not controlled. And so we do, I think, spend a lot more time now trying to reduce pain of infants and neonates than we probably recognized.
But Dr. Adele has said that using some of these studies with respect to STDs is frankly absurd, and I'm wondering what your response is to that, as well as the fact that Intact America and many of these groups that are very stridently opposed to the report that you put out say that they not only, as we've said, to some extent impugn the profession, but they also say that male circumcision and female circumcision are analogous.
Well, I mean, so there's several questions tied up in there. I mean, the STD, the importance of the reduction in the risk of STDs is not trivial. It is absolutely true that the most important things we do is encourage safe sex and the use of condoms and so on, and that should not change. But, you know, we're dealing with a real world, too, where we know many people don't do that. And you know, one of the reasons the World Health Organization has made the argument that circumcision should be an adjunct to an HIV prevention strategy, at least in certain parts of the world, is precisely that, which is that although the primary protection we should be aiming for is safe sex practices, that doesn't always fall into place, and this circumcision may provide some added protection. I'm trying to remember.
Well, I was asking about the analogy. We've been hearing a lot about the analogy to female circumcision.
The analogy there is ridiculous. I mean, the primary reason the two are not analogous is that there have never been a demonstrated medical benefit or any benefit really to female genital cutting. And you could claim that they were a little more analogous if you could say the same about male circumcision, but you can't. There are demonstrated benefits, and they, you know, for the individual child, there's, you know, the likelihood of actually having some benefit is relatively small, but that's different than being absent, and those benefits can be a big deal for some children. You know, a urinary tract infection in infancy is a big deal. They can be quite sick. They can end up in the hospital on IV antibiotics and have all kinds of problems.
I know Dr. Adele wants in here, but I want to give out the phone number and do that immediately now, because I know there are many of you who want to join this conversation or have questions or comments. So let me tell you how you can do that. Our toll-free number is available. It's 866-733-6786. Again, feel free to join us now at 866-733-6786. Whether you're listening on radio, internet, or Sirius satellite, you can also email us forum@kqed.org or post questions or comments on our website by going to kqed.org/forum and clicking on the segment, or by going to our Facebook page. Dean Adell, you were going to add.
Yes, I think this is an important concept here, and the analogy to female circumcision. I would disagree in that, A, female circumcision has not been studied as much, but, you know, labial carcinoma is way more common than penile cancer, and removing the labia of little girls would prevent that in the same way that removing the foreskin, well, you won't get cancer of the foreskin, which is terribly rare in this country. And I know I anecdotally mentioned the East African physician saying, oh, how girls are much much cleaner. You know, it just has not been studied. And we are, you know, parsing very fine, you know, shreds here, trying to come up with some unifying principle. And I would say, excuse me, and I understand Dr. Dikema does have an ethical background, would he object if parents considered waiting for a child to be of an age that they could consent themselves? I mean, that's a compromise I think that maybe all sides could agree upon. Why not let a young man? I certainly wish I had the choice.
Would that include, since you're talking about informed consent for children or lack of informed consent, would that include things like ears pierced and so forth?
Well, I'd be interested in Dr. Dikema's.
Well, actually, I'd be interested too, but we're coming up on a break here. And when we return, we'll get a response from Dr. Dikema. We'll also get responses from you, our listeners, and I remind you there are a number of ways of joining us. Lines are all full, but grab one when it's available. It's toll-free, 866-733-6786, or email us, forum@kqed.org, or go to our Facebook page or our website, kqed.org/forum. Talking with Dr. Dean Adell and Dr. Doug Dikema, and when we return, we'll hear from you. I'm Michael Krasny. You're listening to Forum. I'm Michael Krasny. This week, in fact, on Monday, the American Academy of Pediatrics announced updated circumcision guidelines, which suggest that health benefits outweigh the risks. U.S. circumcision rates for newborn boys have fallen to about 55% from a high of close to 80% in the 70s, and we're getting a lot of response as we take up this debate. Let me just read some of your responses here. Here's Paul, who emails us, female circumcision is done for most of the same reasons as male circumcision, and yet we universally deplore it as genital mutilation. Our boys should have the same protection against unnecessary genital surgery as our girls. If they wish to make the choice as adults, they should be able to make the choice for themselves. Galway says the focus on STD transmission rates misses the forest for the trees. When it comes to sexual behavior, human psychology trumps all, and simply the knowledge of reduced STD rates could very well engender riskier sexual behavior and decision-making in circumcised men. My wife and I are expecting a baby boy in November. He won't be circumcised, and I will be using that fact to instill in him greater caution and awareness of the need to use protection. Jennifer writes, I agree that circumcision is more hygienic, but I passed on doing it when my son was born because I was reluctant to make an irreversible decision for him. Maybe when he's older, he'll opt for it, although I realize it probably involves a harder discovery. Dr. Dina Dell with us, host of a national radio show and veteran in the world of television, giving advice in medical matters. Many years opposed to routine neonatal circumcision, and an ophthalmologist and surgeon. Dr. Doug Dikema, also with us, is a member of the American Academy of Pediatrics Circumcision Task Force, a physician and director of education for the Center for Pediatric Bioethics at Seattle Children's Hospital and professor in the Department of Pediatrics at the University of Washington School of Medicine. He's with us from Seattle, and Dr. Dell is with us from Mendocino County. And before we went to the break, Dr. Dikema, Dr. Dell, I guess, was really asking what your take is on the idea of allowing children to decide rather than allowing parents to decide.
Well, and the way Dr. Dell phrased it, I think, is correct. I am perfectly fine with a parent making that decision. I'm not actually okay with an advocacy group making that decision for parents on behalf of their child. I think parents should consider whether they want to take this decision away from their child. But when they, whatever decision they make, they need to realize that they're losing something. I mean, if you make a decision to circumcise your child, that takes away this choice from him later. On the other hand, if you decide to wait, there you do lose some of the benefits. You lose the benefit related to a reduction in urinary tract infections in the first couple months of life.
Forgive me, but are those numbers around 90%, according to the paper that was referenced in the report by the AAP? 90% reduction of urinary tract infections?
Yes, that's correct. Yeah, it's fairly significant. And it also changes the way we approach babies who are circumcised versus uncircumcised when they present with fever.
I would add, if we'd studied female circumcision, we'd find the same thing. Little girls, I'm sure Dr. Dikema will agree, have 5-10 times the rate of urinary tract infections indeed. And there are studies to even challenge that. So for the first few months or the year of life, I mean, a child is not going to get an STD before they're of age. Oh, I guess I suppose it's possible in their teenage years. And I think it's a reasonable position, as he says, for parents to, you know, weigh the pros and the cons, and it looks like parents kind of have. And it seems to be, if California is a bellwether and running at 20-30%, this seems to be the future as we join the rest of the world. And I'm still curious and haven't heard, why is it that European and Asian and Australian physicians disagree with the AAP position on this? I think that's important. We are kind of isolated in the world in this regard.
Any thoughts about that, Dr. Dikema?
Well, I think, you know, if you look at other medical societies around the world who have written about this issue, I mean, many of them actually come to relatively similar conclusions, but not as strong. But they're also, many of those are dated. Of the ones that are strongly opposed to circumcision, many of them are not based on any kind of a comprehensive and critical review of the literature. In other words, they probably tend to be groups of physicians in those countries who have just come to some consensus, as opposed to really trying to get into the data and analyze it and figure out where it takes them.
Let me go to our callers, and Alex, you're first up here. Join us.
Hi, good morning. I'm a father of three boys. My youngest is 29. My oldest is 35. None of them were circumcised, although I was myself. We haven't noticed, as parents, any urinary infections, other than maybe a little discomfort, you know, at some point or another. But I know my boys are sexually active, no major problems. By the way, we did do home births with our children, and that's about it.
Okay. I'm glad you went on record here with your own experiences, and I thank you for that. And we'll go right on to another caller, and that's Rick. Rick, you're on forum. Good morning.
Hi. So it seems to me like a lot of the research being done is basically, you know, it's, you know, like Western or maybe American Judeo-Christian society trying to come up with a good excuse for its bad behavior. And I think if one of the doctors keeps saying to the other something that's extremely important, and I'm sure they're both familiar with, you know, the statistical things that one has to do to make valid scientific points, but basically, you know, if it weren't for the fact that so many people were looking for benefits for male circumcision, we probably wouldn't have found it. You take any other ritualistic mutilation, like maybe female circumcision, and put the number of studies on it that have been done on male circumcision, and sure, you're going to find an effect. So I wonder if it's not just, you know, some kind of cultural bias, the fact that the people doing the research are also the people doing the circumcisions that has produced, you know, this kind of an effect. And if female circumcision were mainstream in the society of the researchers doing the research, would we not have done thousands of studies and eventually, yes, found an effect with some high p-value, which you're going to find if you do?
Well, Rick, you bring up again the point that Dean Adell was bringing up, cultural differences. You want to comment here, Dean Adell?
Yes, well, there are cultural differences, and I think when you look at the history of this, I think many Christians feel because Jesus was circumcised that it was a reasonable thing, and it has taken hold, you know, in our culture, and it's a fascinating history to follow. And, you know, the female equivalent, I need to go on the record to say, I can imagine how difficult this must have been for the AAP because, you know, there was a year and a half ago, roughly, there was an issue. They came up with a statement on female circumcision for Muslim parents in this country where they recommended that a little cut be made, a little blood be drawn to satisfy, quote, the religious, you know, requirements for female circumcision. It was, you know, an attempt to stop patients from going back to Africa to have this done by substandard practitioners, and yet to recommend, okay, we'll just cut the female clitoris a little bit and let it bleed a little bit. Well, there was a hue and cry and an outcry of gargantuan proportions, and they had to retract the statement. And I offer that not to show how off they can be at times, but the difficulty of trying to meet the demands of a pluralistic society, you know, like we have, where everybody's got a reason, you know, for this. And I also get in trouble with fellow activists because I don't think right now we should be tackling the religious aspects of this. I think what Germany tried to do and what Scandinavia is going to try to do, you know, is very, you know, frightening at this point, although most religions are flexible. You know, most Catholic girls use birth control. Most Jewish people don't observe the Shabbat. Circumcision, though, is very deeply rooted in the ancient traditions of Judaism and by proxy Islam. So I think that's small potatoes. I rather focus on the rest of it, and then I think religious organizations will slowly begin to see, well, maybe we can rethink some of this.
Let me go to some of the listener responses here. Spencer, who writes, can I make a shallow comment? In my opinion, circumcision looks better than uncircumcision, and I don't think I'm alone in this belief. When you're at the most vulnerable, you want to look your best. Some comments on Facebook. I went through circumcision when I was 11 years old. In retrospect, I wish my parents had circumcised me at birth because I wouldn't have remembered the pain afterward. And Jennifer writes on our Facebook page, condoms are great prevention, but newsflash, no one uses them. If they did, we wouldn't have STDs in epidemic proportions. This whole thing is nuts. Circumcision has not been proven to harm a man. Why not let the parents decide? And doing it at birth is 100 times better than later. This is just all crazy. Catherine from Oakland comments online, I did not want to circumcise our son. I could not imagine hurting my little baby. My husband felt so strongly to have him circumcised, to have him look like him and most other males around us. Because our son was premature, it was done when he was 2 weeks old. It was the first time he cried. It really broke my heart. My husband said it was for the best. Years later, my son heard the story and profusely thanked his dad for standing up for him. Some more comments on Facebook. This is Kim who writes, there may be STD advantages to circumcision, but avoidance of disease does not trump the right of boys to remain intact until age 18, when they should be able to make their own decision. Something else seemingly never mentioned is the fact that should a child turn out to be transgendered, an intact foreskin provides for a better outcome when constructing a neo-vagina. And for this reason alone, circumcision should be banned for children. Jen writes on Facebook, reduces transmission of STDs, so does condoms. Reduces risk of penile cancer. It's rare to begin with, and the last time I checked, no one advocates amputating an infant's healthy body parts to prevent cancer. Let the man decide when he's old enough to choose for himself. If it is too painful for a grown man to endure, why on earth would you subject a baby to it? Because the baby is smaller and unable to explain how much it hurts. Let me just give you a few more Facebook comments. You can see there's a whole range and diversity in these comments. Astrid writes on Facebook, who funded the research? I'm wondering if there's a connection to America's Puritan roots, mothers shying away from telling or showing their little boys how to pull back foreskin or wash themselves to keep clean. And Monica writes, nope, not buying the Academy's logic. Why in so many other countries is it only done for religious reasons and not the so-called health benefits? And you're getting a flavor here, of course, of much of what we talked about. But let me go to that question about funding, if I could, with you, Dr. Dikema. Doug Dikema is with us from up in Seattle. There's... as we indicated earlier, 14 studies that have been used here as evidence. And what do we know about the funding of those studies?
Well, I don't know offhand what the funding was. I suspect some of them had federal funding, and you know, who knows about the others. I don't know the answer.
Well, can you cast any light on what the APA's funding for their own research?
Oh, sure. I mean, so, you know...
I'm sorry, the AAP. I said APA.
The AAP, they get their funding primarily through membership fees. And, you know, what I can tell you is they put together this task force that included about 10 individuals, none of whom were paid anything to do this. This was all done on volunteer time. None of whom, as far as I know, had any agenda. We were asked to do a review of the scientific literature, and we were given no instructions about what that was to look like. In other words, in contrast to what some of the critics would like people to believe, the American Academy of Pediatrics leadership never told the task force what conclusion they were to reach, what would be okay and what wouldn't. As far as we were concerned, we could write absolutely anything that was based on the scientific literature and it would be acceptable to the Academy.
Well, one of the things that was written in that report, and I'm quoting from it directly here, and I'd like Dean Adell's response, is, quote, true incidence of complications after newborn circumcision are unknown.
Yes. Well, it is unknown, and while I admit the major complications like, you know, loss of a penis or, you know, heavy, heavy bleeding and infection thankfully seem to be rare, which means when you put the benefit in there against the risks, you get into a tricky spot because the benefits don't have to be perceived to be to be that much. And I don't think that the Academy itself has a bias in these regards. It's biological research is extremely difficult. This whole issue and all the studies, I'm sure Dr. Dikema would admit, is what we would call soft science. It's not physics or chemistry or a placebo-controlled study. It's terribly difficult to sort all this out. And, Michael, if I may jump in, there's just one thing you read that jumped out at me that I think is really important and no one wants to talk about, and that is the aesthetics of this. American women are used to circumcised penises. If you go to Europe, they'll tell you, a woman will say that she prefers it, you know, intact. And I think that American women have been an important drive behind this thing, you know, and the shame of the intact boy in the locker room. We all have heard those stories. Well, I would certainly say in California, with only a 30% circumcision rate, it's going to be reversed, and the circumcised child, circumcised today, is going to be the one who just might be pointed out in the locker room. Not that I approve of such a thing, but the aesthetics of this and the discussions with American women I had are quite horrendous. Imagine if a man were to tell a woman, oh, you have moisture, or, oh, this is not clean, you should therefore, you know, go have, you know, your labia and vulva removed. Women would be outraged by this. Why American men have just stood by and allowed this to perpetuate itself, which is an important part of it. And I'm going to go a step further, and maybe this is, I'm going to the fringe on this, but I think one of the influences today is the incredible penetration of pornography in our lives. And I think a lot of American men or women are seeing, how do I put this delicately, how the intact man handles his foreskin during sex and what he can do with it. There's 15 square inches of foreskin that's missing. The AAP is trying to tell us that this 15 square inches of extremely sensitive position, as extreme sensitivity, which has been objectively demonstrated, is removed. How can that not affect sexuality? We are so uptight about this, we don't want to put this to the fore, because that's the main reason I would tell a parent to put this off, is the child's sexuality, which is very, again, hard to be objective about, but I'm appealing to common sense on this.
Are you suggesting that men who are uncircumcised have more sexual excitement, more sexual stimulation, more sexual pleasure?
There is no doubt when you get as objective as you can and try to talk to them. There's one African study where the men did not report a difference, but, you know, surveys are tough.
You know, many circumcised men would tell you differently, sure.
And the problem is, it's just like with women with hysterectomies and sex. If a man has a circumcision as an adult because he had, I don't know, he had an infection or someone made fun of him, who knows what, he's very likely to be biased towards the circumcised state afterwards. So it's very difficult to be objective about it. But once again, I would say that we are questioning the wisdom of nature and or God, depending upon your beliefs, in terms of why this organ was put there. So it's got to be my favorite cartoon, it's a little anachronistic, but it's Abraham standing on a mountain looking up at God and saying, wait a second, what is it you want us to do? It's the strangest thing while we picked on this particular organ.
Are you sure it wasn't about killing his son Isaac, as was commanded?
That's pretty handy, too.
By the way, a link to the AAP recommendations is at our website, www.kqed.org/forum, and just click on this segment, and let me click on another caller here. Beth, that's you. Welcome. You're on the air.
Hi, thank you. One of the most contentious arguments, and it lasted for months, that my partner and I had when I was pregnant with our son, she's Jewish and I'm Christian, and she really wanted to circumcise, and I strongly didn't. And, I have a brother who's not circumcised, who is adamant and, strong, he basically refers to circumcision as mutilation and is adamant about, defending his intactness and feeling like it's brutal. And I had a roommate in college who was circumcised and was a gay roommate who had an uncircumcised partner, and he really grieved his lost foreskin and was very vocal with me about that. And I just said, and my partner was really concerned about a bar mitzvah. And what if he wants to have a bar mitzvah? Can he do that if he's not circumcised? And I basically said, look, I don't want to make this decision. I know men who, I'm not a man. I don't want to make this decision and have him regret it. If he wants to be circumcised later, he can do that. But he can't uncircumcise himself later. And I just feel like it should be, I almost want to take the stand that I feel like it should be illegal for adults to be making this decision for tiny children. Let them make the decision when they're 14 if they want to get have a bar mitzvah, or they can have a bar mitzvah without being circumcised. I've discussed it with rabbis.
All right.
Let them make the decision when they're 18. Who are we to make this decision for these children?
Yeah, no, I appreciate your call, and I thank you for it. We're sort of skirting around, I guess, the religious questions here, because we wanted to talk about the health benefits in the AAP report, but obviously it needs to be said that this plays a very significant role, not only for those of the Jewish faith, but those of the Muslim faith as well.
Yes, Michael, I would say, it's interesting in terms of disclosure. I see a lot of, maybe this is wrong again, I see a lot of Jewish names, I'm Jewish, so I can say this, that are very, very pro-circumcision. And it goes back to a deep, horrible period in our history, when, your pants were pulled down in World War II, and if you're circumcised, you die because you went to a concentration camp. It's the only way I can explain the fever pitch that some Jewish physicians embrace this issue. And a lot of funding for circumcision in Africa over the HIV thing, which I just think it's silly.
But you have to go way beyond the Holocaust, though. This was Mosaic law, right?
This was
Bible and all that.
Oh, absolutely. But the fear, why is it that Jews seem to want that the rest of the population is circumcised so as not to isolate us in a way? And I, It's complex. It's complex, and yet when I see, you know, the Israelis getting heavily involved in circumcising in Africa, you know, I guess have to roll my eyes. This would be like talking again. No, I'm not meaning to offend anybody, but if you wanted to talk about, you know, birth control, you'll probably find different opinions among Catholic physicians than Protestant physicians. Even though we're all scientists, we're all doctors, and we're all supposed to be objective, it influences us.
Well, here's a listener, Faye, who writes, during World War II in the Pacific, there was a medical study claiming that circumcised soldiers had lower infection rates, especially so in hot, humid island locations. Is there any validity to that? Do you know about that, Dr. Dikema?
Well, we looked specifically at children, so we didn't look at that kind of a study with regard to, somebody on a South Pacific island, but...
It gets a little arcane, I realize, but we also have listeners, and some of our listeners are certainly aware of a lot of esoteric things. I'm getting a couple of emails about penile cancer. How common is penile cancer, first of all?
It's very uncommon, I think we would both admit, and you'd probably have to do 1,000 or 2 circumcisions to prevent one, if indeed, and there's questions about that. I mean, I would simply raise up, you know, vulvar cancer in women, and you want to remove vulvar and labia. I mean, obviously, if you remove something, it's healthier. And, you know, the South Pacific Island thing, Michael, actually has a relevance, because in the AAP report, and I was surprised by this, and that just one sentence they have in there that says that not washing the complete penis is 10 times more common, not washing the complete penis, more common in intact men. I have no idea, you know, why that would be, and certainly that could explain some of these differences that they feel they've observed. And in Africa, there was a study that bringing soap and water to a village, soap and water, allowing men to wash themselves, eliminated a lot of the risks that are attributed to having a foreskin in a place where there is no water. In the South Pacific, washing was very difficult. Yes, you have to use soap and water on many parts of your body.
Well, let me go to Dr. Dikema on that, because I know, for example, couples who have elected not to have their son circumcised and then complained that they were under the impression that washing the right way and keeping that area clean would prevent problems, but that the children didn't necessarily follow those rules, or they weren't as quick to do the kind of hygienic things that they were supposed to be doing, or they were even being trained to do, if you will. Did that come into focus at all, Dr. Dikema?
Well, I mean, we looked at some of those issues. I think maintaining hygiene will possibly reduce the incidence of infections of the foreskin, which are not sexually transmitted infections. It's actually probably the most common reason I see kids in my practice in the emergency room who have foreskins is for something we call balanitis, which is an infection of the foreskin. But the odds are hygiene is not going to make a difference with regard to acquisition of HIV or human papillomavirus or some of the sexually transmitted diseases. I think that's
The data is pretty clear on that, yeah. Let me get another caller on here. We have Amir joining us. Amir, go ahead.
Hi, yes, Michael. Thanks. I'm a huge fan of your show. I just wanted to say that I was born in a Muslim country. I was born in Iran, where circumcision is done unquestioningly. Me and my wife had a daughter 14 months ago, and before her birth, we didn't know the sex of the child. So we had to have this conversation, and when we started, you know, looking into it, I sort of thought, we would just do this because it was done to me, and it's, you know, the language that's used is foreskin, so it's just a little bit of skin that you remove. But when I looked into it more and more, and when I'm not a doctor by practice, but when I looked into it and I used my common sense, I just came to the conclusion that it's a barbaric practice. I mean, who am I to make this decision for another human being? I think the rights of a child really are being ignored here. And I mean, I think if we used it, if we described it as something other than skin, I think people wouldn't feel the same way about it.
You know, this keeps coming up. Amir, I thank you for the call. Dr. Dikema, about the rights of the child. And how does the AAP look at that whole issue?
Well, the rights of the child are very important to the AAP, but this is also a situation in which you're talking about something that does have some potential benefits. And I think the Academy's feeling is that parents are best situated in situations where there may be some benefit and some risk to the child
in making a decision to be the one who makes that decision, which is why we feel this should be a parental decision and not the decision of someone else. As I mentioned before, you can it's something I think parents should think about, which is, do I want my own child to make this decision later on? But in doing that, you do lose some of the potential benefits. And there are kids who acquire sexually transmitted diseases. There are definitely teenagers who acquire human papillomavirus before the age of 18, when they would really, you know, sort of reach the age of consent. And so I think parents ought to be the ones who make that decision. And that was sort of the thrust of our statement.
Well, here's Nora from Los Gatos, who says, I just heard Dr. Dean Adel say most Jewish people don't celebrate Shabbat. Where does he get this from, and what on earth was the relevance of the comment? His views on circumcision are well known and revealed by this remark, which I think was intended to suggest that he doesn't respect even the fire that religious practice is a valid consideration.
Michael, step in and help me. Obviously, most Jews do not observe the Shabbat. Do you think most Jews do?
I haven't seen stats. I can't say.
Come on, Michael. No, I'm just saying that there are Jews who are not circumcising their children who are updating the ritual, just like there are, you know, Catholics who take birth control. Gee, I'm allowed to say those things. I also would say, you know, in terms of the STD thing, we have a huge rate of STDs in this country. It is a terrible problem, and yet we are the most circumcised Western nation there is. So, you know, you have to reconcile that. You know, one piece of data doesn't explain the other. But nevertheless, to assume that if you don't circumcise your child, they'll be riddled with STDs is fear-mongering. Is fear-mongering. And I think
But that's not the assumption we've made. What we've said is what the data shows, which is that there is a reduction in the risk. I don't think anybody's fear-mongering here.
Well, I would say the interesting thing is if you support all those statements, then why? Then why did you not recommend routine circumcision of newborns?
Because I'm not answering for you, but I think it says in the report you wanted parents to make the choice, have the choice for themselves, just like pro-choice people say about abortion.
But they admit that there isn't enough benefit to recommend it, and therefore how can they ethically give that right to parents? A parent can't...
Quick response from Dr. Dikema.
We do that all the time in medicine. There are some things where we make strong recommendations because it's so important to a child. There are other things that we don't recommend because it's not important to a child. And there are many things where we give parents a choice because there's some benefit, but there are also some risks, and we think they ought to weigh those.
Well, we've come to the end of the hour. That will have to be the final word on this, but the debate can go on our website, kqed.org/forum. Thanks to Dr. Doug Dikema, Dr. Dean Adel, and thanks to you. Another hour ahead. I'm Michael Krasny.
Funds for the production of Forum are provided by the members of KQED Public Radio, the Germanicos Foundation, and the Generosity Foundation in honor of Louise and Claude Rosenberg, and by a generous gift from Jan Schrem and Maria Minetti Schrem, owners of Clos Pegas Winery, who believe that all people deserve access to education, information, and culture for a lifetime of exploration and learning.